I said that in my paper on the imprint of man's mind, the one that I gave in Toronto to the high school teachers of English, that they had left a little autobiographical bit out. Well, it's not all that autobiographical, but I thought you might like to have it anyway. It comes at page 19 of the printed version, and I guess that's where the printer came unstuck and they had to revise something by sticking a piece of type over the bottom of page 19. It comes after the phrase, without binoculars and without a Peterson's guide. This is what I wrote. Let me be a little autobiographical. As far back as I can remember, growing up in a small Ontario town, I was always fascinated by words and language, as well as by music, and as a child listened entranced to the talk of my parents and grandparents and their friends. We were read aloud to a great deal as children. I learned to read very early and read voraciously throughout childhood. Much of what I listened to and read was way over my head. That made it all the more fascinating. My father and grandfather were both keen classical scholars. Although Latin was then holding on only by the skin of its teeth in the schools and Greek had vanished, I began to learn Latin at about 7 and Greek a couple of years later. At school, in which classes were small and discipline strict according to principles that would now be judged archaic and perhaps oppressive, we were thoroughly trained in spelling, parsing, analysis, reading aloud, writing correctly and in a clear hand, not copperplate, but as I discovered years later, italic. I don't know what the effect was on my peers, except that most became articulate and some were to become a little eminent. For myself, this training provided a confident craftsmanship in handling language that came to my call long before I had any intention of writing anything for publication. The advantage of working in 3 languages, actually 4 because we were also trained thoroughly in reading French, was immense, especially when 2 of them are as different in mentality, structure and texture as Latin and Greek are. I continued in classical studies until, by the beginning of the war, I had taken 2 university degrees and had taught in a school for 2 years. I don't remember that any study of literature in school up to matriculation presumed to attempt any what we now call criticism. We were simply induced to get to know certain books and poems, to read them accurately and with pleasure. Our teachers must have been quite deft. In any case, I still think of the business of criticism as getting to know works of literature with the purpose of extending and clarifying awareness. I still have 3 Shakespeare plays almost word for word by heart from the age of 9 or 10, from having them read aloud to us, and from reading aloud various parts in them. Many phrases and passages of Shakespeare and other poets, together with the King James Bible and certain Latin mnemonics, stuck in my mind at that time and still resonate to the lightest touch. I still remember vividly how at the age of 11 or 12 I came upon the feeling of being possessed by poems, as though the windows of the mind had suddenly been flung open on a sunny morning. Particularly Virgil's Aeneid Book 2 in Latin, and Wordsworth's Immortality Ode. Once sitting in sunlight with my back against a limestone wall, the other time walking on a spring day down a steep hill on my way home from school. In neither case had anybody ventured to talk about symbolism or social settings or hidden meanings or types of ambiguity or archetypes or techniques of communication. I had experienced something of inestimable value, indispensable, I later found, for studying literature. I now knew what it felt like to enter the life of a poem, to be commanded and shaped and exalted by that life. Much later I recognized at once what Robert Frost meant when he said, "The right reader of a good poem can tell, the moment it strikes him, that he has taken an immortal wound and knows that he will never get over it." My study of music, carried on in childhood as passionately as anything else, brought me to realize that the feeling of great poetry was exactly like the feeling of great music, that it was as simple, direct, shapely, and powerful as that, that it came in through the ear and was nourished by submission, by listening. I came to be an instructor in English in a university entirely by accident, 10 days after leaving my last ship, after almost 6 years of seafaring, with no more formal preparation for that task than a first-year undergraduate survey of English literature, and what I had read on my own. So I guess there is something to be said for the old-fashioned, allegedly oppressive ways of teaching, and something to be said, too, for the lucky accident of growing up in a house full of books and music and talk. For in our house, talk went on incessantly, it seems, on any subject, from fishing to naval gunnery, from the foibles of neighbours to the philosophy of history, from the grafting of apple trees to carpentry and the design of rifle sights, from sculpture to needlework and the management of a no-trump hand and bridge, from politics to the lubricating system of aero engines, the names of stars and constellations and how to find them, how to use an axe and how to get a good watercolor wash on paper to bring up a granular pattern, about the characteristics of anastigmatic lenses and the manipulation of photographic papers in various chemicals, about Clara Schumann and how she had to sit in her music when she gave a public recital, about ghosts and premonitions, and the ways the mind can ignore space and time, about linotype machines and printing and the shapes of letters written and printed, the identities and names of birds and trees, flowers and grasses, fishes and clouds, the way of boats on the river and of ships at sea, methods of astronomical navigation, ways of finding your way in the woods, ways of finding your way through a musical score or a difficult book. One of my father's usual cautionary remarks was, "Not necessarily." There was an Amazon parrot in the house, too, who taught me something about the breathtaking appropriateness with which a limited vocabulary can be managed.